I'd like to first acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. We're holding this seminar on the land of the Eora Nation and the Gadigal of the Gadigal people, so I'd like to pay my respects to the present and past owners of the land. Welcome to UTS, where the council sort of located. Anyway, that's where the things are stored and that's where we meet, but we have a new committee for the council for 2009, and we've got several of the executive members in this room. I don't know if you'd like to kind of wave your hand or say who you are.
Hello, I'm Desiree O'Regan, and I'm a head teacher of AB NSL at Newton.
And I'm Jude Cook, outreach coordinator at Little Park.
I'm Janet Dine from Osmo ABE.
Pam Osman from the Hotline at the moment. We should have writing out the
And Steve Zuck, who's our speaker, is also on the council, and I'll interview Steve in a minute. There are a few others from the committee who aren't able to be here, but it's a council of made up of volunteers who have made a commitment to work with literacy and literacy practitioners in New South Wales to give voice to the field and to the practitioners, their concerns, their aspirations, and we hope that you'll all contribute and participate and be active to help us do that. As I said, we're all volunteers, so we don't have a lot of resources. The only resources we have come from the membership fees, and there are membership forms on the table where Pam's sitting, so I invite all of you to join. The more members we have, the more we can do, the more interesting things we can do, and so I hope we can become a very vibrant council. So I'd like to now introduce Steve Black, who's our speaker for this evening. He's going to talk about whatever happened to adult basic education. I think Steve's name anyway, if not face, is familiar to many of you. He's been doing a lot of research that many people are drawing on language literacy, numeracy and social capital. He's also, until very recently, been the head teacher, senior head teacher in adult basic education at Middlebury State. So I think without further ado, I'll hand over to Steve. The plan, I think, is that Steve will present, and I think you want it to be interactive.
Yeah, I'd rather people chip in. If you've got something to say, please say it. Don't wait for 5 minutes at the end. Not quite sure how this is going to go across, really. I should say that what I have to say is very practice-based. Essentially, what I have are comments from adult basic education teachers in TAFE about their practice, about how they teach and different aspects of their pedagogy. It's not a theoretical workshop at all. And I should explain that I've recently retired from TAFE a couple of months ago. I first got involved in adult literacy back in 1980. So I got a job down in jail, Long Bay Prison, teaching literacy. And I didn't have a clue how to teach literacy. I didn't know anything about it. And I found out later I got the job because I was the only one who didn't have another agenda. I wasn't a do-gooder. I was there basically to help people to improve their reading and writing. I wasn't there to convert anyone and apparently there are other motives to... Oh, Maggie, you worked in the jail. Yeah, you know all about that.
I bet you
did. That's a long time ago though, 1980. Nearly 30 years. It was my introduction to adult literacy. And throughout the 80s and 90s, and up until a couple of years ago, it's taken over my sort of professional life, but more than that, I've always had a big commitment to adult literacy. It's involved me, it's always fascinated me. When I left TAFE just a couple of months ago, I left as quite a discontented TAFE teacher. Something has happened in recent years that my job was no longer enjoyable. And that's part of what I'm looking at today, really. What has changed in adult basic education? Not just in recent years, probably gradually over the last decade, that has made the job of teaching adult literacy and numeracy, I'm sorry if I've missed out numeracy sometimes, Keiko, but when I say literacy, I really mean numeracy as well. What has changed this field in recent years that certainly made it less enjoyable for me and possibly for quite a few other teachers as well? In fact, I have discovered there are quite a few other teachers who have some reservations about it. It's a different field now from what it was in the 1980s, 1990s. And I must admit, a lot of what I have to say is TAFE stuff. Now, if you're not in TAFE, there'll be acronyms and stuff that you may not be familiar with. I'll try and be aware of that, explain what we mean by some of the terminology, but I'm coming from a TAFE perspective. That's where I've been for the last, 20 or more years. And I know quite a few of you are from TAFE, but quite a few of you aren't from TAFE. It's basically a little bit about me, because I think you need to know where I'm coming from in order to understand the perspective that I'm on about here. So I've said in 30 years I've been around in adult literacy and numeracy. When I got involved in adult literacy, these are the sorts of things we talked about. This was how our field was characterised, if you like. We all spoke about student-centred and student-directed learning. Curriculum was always based on students' needs. There was the notion of negotiating with students over their needs. We talked about empowerment. The name Paulo Freire came up quite often. I'm not saying none of this exists now, but this was the field that I joined in the 1980s. And adult literacy and numeracy was essentially a small group. There were one-to-one tuition going on. There was something called RAWFA, where you're only allowed to have six students and one teacher. That carried on for many, many years, that RAWFA provision. The adult basic ed field was also characterised by, strong networks. ACAL still is quite strong, but maybe I perceived it to be a bit stronger then. The New South Wales Adult Literacy and Numeracy Council was really quite a strong, thriving organisation. I remember the council meetings we used to have down at the Adult Literacy Information Office. There was competition to get jobs in those days. And ALEO, some of you will remember ALEO, the Adult Literacy Information Office, that's gone. There was a place in Melbourne called ARIS, it's a resource centre, that's now gone. There were places you could go specifically for adult literacy. It was known as a growth business. There were heaps and heaps of students doing the graduate diploma here when it was ITATE and later on when it became a university. I'm sure some of you have got the graduate diploma in basic education that you did here. And the teachers, the cohort of teachers at the time in the 80s and 90s, they were in their 30s and 40s. That's the scene that I remember that I came into. And just did a little research study that I've been doing, because I'm interested in, a couple of aspects. I was a head teacher for the last 16, 17 years, a head teacher of adult basic education. So there's two things that I've been really interested in, which is the role of the head teacher and adult basic ed teaching. And in the last couple of years, I've wanted to document those changes in the field. And I've tried to do this in several ways. I've had support from the TAFE Teachers Association in undertaking this study. And basically it taps into, if you're in TAFE, you might have seen this report on head teachers that I've produced earlier in the year. It sort of dovetails this. I'm using some of the information that I obtained through a survey questionnaire sent out to head teachers. I also did a lot of interviews on one-to-one with individual adult basic ed teachers. And I also, quite interestingly, taped some focus group meetings. I went around to several staff meetings in several TAFE colleges in the adult basic ed section, and we taped almost like an informal meeting of staff. We had a few focus questions and the tape was running. So a lot of what I have to say is fairly sort of conversational gut reactions on what people think has been happening to the field. And the sorts of questions I was asking, the sorts of things I want to know is whether what you teach now, the content, has it changed from what you used to teach 10 years, 15 years ago? What about how you teach? Do you use any different methods? Or are there different issues currently? Have the students changed? The demographics? Are you dealing with different types of students now from, 10, 15 years ago? Are you audit compliant? How do you respond to auditing which is a big factor in TAFE these days. And what are your views on the future of ABE? It's only a small study. It's basically out of my personal interest, although I'm getting a bit of help, support from the TAFE Teachers Association in order to do it. But it's not a big, large-scale one. It's based on qualitative, local information. And basically what I have here is what they say in those interviews. It's what one head teacher said. We're now always being audited. 10 years ago, I didn't know what an audit was. We're now being, either internally or externally. So you always have this unseen audience there. Sometimes you feel they're ready to pounce. So you need to make sure you're covered maybe for something that will never eventuate anyway. So there's always hovering over an ABE section the possibility of an audit, of being checked up on. And if anyone's been involved in one of those audits, it's really a big thing. If the external auditors, the NCVR people, come in for 2 or 3 weeks before that audit, there's a massive amount of work that goes on in the section. People go around checking to make sure every aspect of the management of that section is being run properly. So one aspect then is those audits that are always hovering over people and the possibility of being affected. That's what another teacher said, another head teacher of ABE. Absolutely everything has changed. Everything that made the job satisfying has been reduced and in most cases eliminated. Key performance indicators are driving our lives and ruining the quality of work, services, products and our capacity to assist students. Budgets, ASH, AQTF, documentation dominate head teachers' lives. That was the head teacher, the experienced head teacher said that. It's not terribly flattering, and I guess it resonates to a certain extent with the way I was feeling as well when I left the field. If you're not in TAFE, you may not understand ASH, which I think stands for Annual Student Hours.
Actual student hours.
And it's very important in TAFE because it's what determines the budget that you get in a section. You are given a certain ASH target. The place I used to work at Metabank TAFE, we were told we had to get 60,000 ASH. It's actual student hours. It's the number of students times the nominal number of hours in the course. And that's how TAFE is budgeted these days. You get given an ASH target and you get given a budget. Now, ASH was something that we never spoke about 10 years ago, didn't have a clue. In fact, when I first got the job at Metabank, you simply, if you could find extra classes, you just took them on. There was no problem. And no one ever said, look, no, you're going to run out of money. It was almost, you basically catered to the demand of the number of students that came through. Now, it's different. We got told, look, you've got to have your dollar ASH per student down to $6.97 because that's what the other ABE sections are doing. And that was the sole criterion. We just had to get to this. So we had to play with figures until $6.97 came up and then we're okay. In other words, the driving force behind how you run a section now in basic education is whether you can come up with your ASH targets and fit your budgets. We're driven to putting in more and more. Head teachers play around with these figures. You've got to reach those targets. The only way you can get your ASH targets up is to either get more students to the courses or run more units or both. So you've either got to put more people in the classroom, so whereas it used to be 6 to 1, you've got to get 10 or 12 students in that class. If it used to be 15 to 1, it might 20 or more need to go in the class. Or you have to run lots more units. That's the only way to get those ASH targets up. Someone else said curriculum has taken control of identifying learners' needs. And someone else said it's also totally assessment driven now. Does this gel? Is this... I mean, even if you're not in TAFE...
I see.
You're in a community college, don't you?
Exactly. Hours to reach as less money as possible.
Yeah. And in none of that is education or teaching mentioned at all.
I think that's part of why I was disillusioned, because I spent all my time on a computer calculating figures rather than dealing with student needs necessarily. But that was me as a head teacher. What about you as a teacher?
Well, once again, because we know there's that pressure, we have more students in our classes. We used to be able to do reasonably well and easily in individual programs. You can't do that in the classroom. It's much bigger.
What about units that you run?
Yes.
Is that a game in your...
It is, yes. We sometimes add in extra units to get more ash.
I know the teachers that I employed, they were always complaining that we just keep loading on more units, more learner outcomes that they have to address. It became almost impossible in the end.
Yeah, well we don't have too many. I think it's possible. We seem to keep it at a possible number. But to look at it, you know, to someone looking, you think, oh, is that all you're teaching? You know, four little units. Particularly language stuff, English, reading and writing, it's very hard to, I'm extremely glad that the units that we've been given are very open-ended and not, because otherwise we'd spend even more time ticking more boxes.
It depends on the institute, it depends on the college as well. If you're a different institute with a different budgetary problems, then you the situation may be quite different.
Well, I think the curriculum has changed as well, Steve, that you know, we've moved towards, well, in case units of competencies. So, whereas, I mean, if you look at going from RAWFA to CASE to FAVE to unit-based enrolment, you know, when RAWFA, at the same time as RAWFA, Reading and Writing for Adults, we had the CASE, which was a certificate of adult foundation education. You had three strands of literacy and numeracy for work, literacy and numeracy for personal and social, and I think literacy and numeracy for further study. And within these three modules, you use that as your umbrella to help your students achieve their literacy and numeracy goals. But these have been broken down into lots of little units of competencies, and now we're required to assess against each of those. And so, and it is checked, it is auditable, and it puts a lot of pressure. But again, I guess it depends what institute you're from, but I won't say which institute I'm from, but certainly we're expected to be very compliant and to have, for each of those units, you know, X amount of assessment tasks, the cover page, and so on. So it's a large part of your time. It's taken documenting, so that, you know, I'm not saying that I don't enjoy teaching. I do, but all of these certainly come in the way of...
So the frustration is that the auditing and compliance isn't about pedagogy, is it?
No.
So if it was about that, you could live with it.
Yeah.
It used to be a straightforward thing. If you were teaching reading and writing for adults, you just enrolled them in the course. Sometimes you didn't enroll them. And they didn't have learning outcomes. It was based on you just negotiated the learning outcomes. No one actually checked on the actual learning outcomes. There were maybe one, perhaps two units in the course at the most. Now, if you looked at a role for one of our classes, say now at Meadowbank, there could be six or seven different units for one, say, the equivalent of a RAWFA class.
I'm working at a small RTO up in Kimberley, and we were ordered about four times in 2 years. Like, it was extraordinary, the amount of energy that went into having to prepare for audits. And we were doing a good job, and the students were very, very enthusiastic and everything like that. But it was suggested to me that in this little outstation adult education said we should open only 4 days a week, so the fifth day I could get up to date with the paperwork and comply properly with HCCS. And we didn't go that way, but that was suggested, so that when the auditors came, you know, just to be sure everything was okay. But we didn't go that way, but it was a huge lot of work in your own time and
It's a boring topic, audits as well, but more and more it's dominating, it certainly dominates the lives of head teachers, but it's dominating the lives of regular teachers as well, part-time and full-time.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I used it for my own evil purposes in a way. I wanted to do a technology check of what people wanted to do in the section because everyone wants to do different things. And at the top I put technology audit. It wasn't an audit, but I knew people would fill it out if I called it that. So I deliberately did that and yes, not a good idea. But it worked. Everyone filled it out because they thought they had to.
Because
it's an audit. Yeah, because
it's an audit. Someone's going to check it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know that our students would have any comprehension of why they were enrolled in the units they're enrolled in or what that meant. So it's totally meaningless to the students. And I think the students have a right to know about their education. You know, and it's being done in a way that's foreign to them, that is hard to explain.
If you're a head teacher, you wouldn't appreciate the top one. Someone suggested that's what we have teachers for. The compliance, the audit stuff. I don't know if you agree with this, that's right. Everything is much more frenetic than it used to be. More admin, accountability, constant bits of paperwork, constant audits. They all impinge on the amount of time you have for preparation for dealing with students. Assessment of validation, that's assessment validation, something I'd never heard of that until a few years ago. The whole idea is that you to assess students, I mean, the whole notion of assessing adult basic education students is a bit problematic anyway. But the idea is that you can't give an assessment task to students now without that being that task being validated by other teachers, confirmed that you're actually following the curriculum. So as someone said there, assessment validation is probably the straw that broke the camel's back. Especially when we saw the level of validation that was going on in other colleges. I think the last point there is that we're trying to be very clever and smart and do the right thing, but you've got other sections, you don't realise what's going on in other sections in the college because you've got some of the major trade sections that may not be doing assessment validation and stuff terribly well, and it could be more significant for them in the sense that there are certain licensing standards where assessment validation could be pretty important. But ABE, I'm not so sure it is. It seemed really to be a matter of getting the balance right. What was rather encouraging, I think, about the conversations that I had with adult basic ed teachers was that they haven't lost sight of the fact that the student really is most important. So someone suggested, I think we're probably better able to take risks and looking at the person first and not the unit first. We've never looked at the units first and gone along and delivered. So even though you've got all this curriculum pressure, essentially for the teachers that I interviewed, the student remained at the centre. So we've become sharper about accountability, but we're still flexible. We do it in a way that we think is best for the student. I think the third point, I think it's quite interesting though, we're getting mixed messages. We're saying you've got to be accountable, but teachers are saying, well, I haven't got enough time to deliver those units. But then on top of that we're saying, and in the tape it was in a whisper, don't worry about that. So that's a mixed message. We want you to be accountable, but don't get anal about it. Don't get too worried about it. There are mixed messages. We're saying, look, accountability, you've got to take it really seriously, but oh, hang on, you know, maybe don't worry too much about it. Teachers maybe don't know exactly where they stand. The LLNP, is everyone familiar with that? It's a Language, Literacy and Numeracy program. It's basically, it's the Centrelink program. They're all those Centrelink clients that are sent along to TAFE colleges and other colleges to improve their literacy. And it's particularly problematic. Anyone who's worked on the LLNP program, there's a massive amount of administration and assessments required with that course. So this was a dialogue involving four teachers. And the first teacher said, the LLNP is probably more of a drag than anything on assessment because it's not assessed in the same way. You've got the curriculum, and then you've got this, what she called friggin' ACDC. You've got to realise this was in a staff meeting. She didn't mean ACDC. Do you know what she meant? There's something called the Australian Core Skills Framework. I'm pleased that that acronym doesn't run off people's tongues anymore. It's a new framework that we use. It's replaced the national reporting system for assessing them. And someone suggested, what a pathetic document that is. This is a very TAFE thing. If you're in TAFE, if you're dealing with the LLNP, you'd realise that there's a massive amount of assessment. And the last verse there, well, the auditors are ruling, aren't they, basically. So what does all this do to teachers? There's a certain amount of resentment. One teacher suggested belittlement, another teacher suggested anger. That they spend so much of their out of face-to-face time doing this validation and accountability work rather than developing resources for my class. I resent that, she said. Another teacher said she found it quite belittling that after working for 15 years in adult basic education, you think that she would be trusted to provide her own assessment for students without it having to be validated. So she felt that that sort of undermined her professionalism in some way. And the last one down there as well, again, it makes people upset and angry that after being in assessment validation makes people angry because professional staff have been teaching for a long time, they've got qualifications, sound qualifications, and there seems to be a lack of trust by having to have everything validated all the time. I tried to put this in a little framework of I tried to work out how do people respond to audits. And I've basically worked out a typology. It's only very rough and it doesn't really, it's not definitive, but it's just a rough working way of how people respond to audits. And the first type of people I call deniers. They're the people who virtually deny that anything's changed. So in other words, someone asks a question, do you feel some sort of obligation to meet the learning outcomes of the curriculum? And the teacher answered, I don't, give me a box. I'll tick it. In other words, she'll tick anything that she's given, doesn't care. It's just a way of getting past the audit process. And I'm sorry to say, I fit into that category to a certain extent myself as a head teacher. When I'd say, look, give me an assessment validation sheet, I don't care, I don't want to read, I'll just sign it. It's a way of almost denying that anything has changed. Let's just carry on as normal, just do these ticks, get them out the way. Another teacher said, look, I'm not going to be driven by what that says there, the curriculum. First of all, I don't understand it. In other words, she's going to go her own way. So there's one set of people I call them deniers. I don't think there's many in currently who can deny the auditing processes. There's another group I call the pragmatists who have to go part way for the auditing process. So one teacher said, look, I'll be honest with you. I'll throw in an assessment. But my assessments are specifically aimed to keep that side of things happy. I'll do it in one session, tick the boxes, but the rest of the time I'll do what's needed. In other words, you have to go some way to meet the auditors. So part of the lesson, or one lesson, she'll spend doing what the curriculum says. The rest of the time she'll carry on teaching the way she would normally have taught. And someone said, it was in a staff meeting, one person suggested that you wouldn't go too far down this tick the box thing without someone saying, oh, for goodness sake, for God's sake, you know, we're not going to go that far. It's almost as though a professional group of people will only go so far in terms of compromising what they do before they say, no, look, we're not going to go any further. And another group you might call the compliers, people who comply with the auditing. There was one question and answer there. Someone suggested, well, what if you just tick them anyway? Does it really matter? Just tick them. And the teacher said, well, I probably would, but some things I just can't. I've got to do some things related to it, even if it's one lesson. So in other words, teachers like to do the right thing. They're not prepared. They don't want to put a tick for something when they really haven't covered that at all in the curriculum. And a lot of them aren't prepared to do that. I don't know too much about numeracy, but numeracy apparently was a little bit different. There's a real difference with numeracy because it's really segmented. This is the curriculum, the numeracy curriculum that TAFE teachers are confronted with. You can't cover the numeracy quite as holistically as you can with the literacy. So we had one teacher there who was just teaching one module for that whole semester on measurement, and that was it. It was the curriculum that determined that. So whereas in a literacy class you might have five or six units all collapsed together, integrated, the numeracy teachers are saying, well, no, you can't do that with numeracy. The way the curriculum is framed, you just can't teach it holistically. They're being forced to... Is that right?
I try and teach it holistically. I don't... I mean,
I would think anyway, if you were teaching measurements for a whole curriculum, you would also be covering lots of other things that were in different units. You couldn't help it. You'd be doing addition and subtraction and...
Yeah, and you'd probably progress literacy too, because...
Yes.
They go really well together, the literacy units and the numeracy units. If you did a, I mean, you're saying you need to have lots of units together, but you could put, you know, a reading unit and a writing unit and probably a numeracy, put a numeracy one as well, and you take the numeracy from the literacy, you wouldn't have written in there, you know, you would have unpacking it through your literacy and put the numeracy in as well. I find they work quite well together, you know. Mm.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see much point in just doing numeracy.
It's cropped up in two staff meetings. They both said that numeracy was not quite so easy to integrate.
But that's because the curriculum, the way numeracy is expressed in the curriculum is different to the way it's expressed in the literacy curriculum. So people who are trying to comply with the curriculum find it difficult to...
If they complied with the curriculum, they could only really teach one aspect at a time. A few other aspects of changing in pedagogy, the class size we've already mentioned, the 6-to-1 might be now a 10-to-1. The second quote down there, there are so many, 25, 30 in some classes, but I think that teacher was referring to a trade class where they were providing tutorial and learner support to that class. There might be 25, 30 in that class, whereas before there might have been, I don't know, 20, 15 to 20. One teacher suggested, well, look, we wanted to join two elective classes together and team teach, but the number of people in the room just made it physically stressful and unmanageable. It wasn't possible. So in other words, the increase in class sizes is changing the way you teach. The issue of critical literacy as well. Someone suggested, I feel that critical literacy has kind of got lost along the way. There's nothing within the curriculum that promotes it and reinforces it. To which someone responded, because they don't want people to think, you just toe the line. Critical literacy was a big issue in the 80s, 90s. It doesn't seem to be an issue that we talk about too much these days in classrooms, AB classrooms.
Because I was looking at a thing on critical literacy today in the curriculum, and it reads very much as though critical literacy is looking at different genres and seeing what their purpose is. I don't think that's critical literacy, but that's kind of how it's written now.
Didn't have quite the political edge that it might have.
Not at all.
And computers are making quite a bit of difference as well. Someone suggested if you come in and observe what happens in classrooms now, you see a lot of computer-based stuff, meeting individual needs, but also workshop-type stuff on computers. I don't think you'd see that sort of critical literacy that we flirted with a few years ago. Students might have changed as well. These are all to do with the demographics of students, that we don't get as many English-speaking background, predominantly Asian NESBs, depends on the college. A lot more international students. The people we have walking through the door are more complex. A lot of people with multiple diagnosed disabilities. I think one of the staff meetings I went to, someone tried to explain that the counsellors, I think, are seeing more and more people with disabilities and referring them onto the ABE section. So ABE sections are having to deal with more complex students with a whole host of problems that they may not have had to have dealt with in the past. One suggestion, and the people at the bottom were in I don't like the expression, but you have to see it in the context of a conversation here, that people are being forced into training and work. Now, you know, a couple of decades ago, there wasn't the same pressure to force everyone on a different pensions and different categories of welfare onto work. But now there is, and they're bubbling up with us, she suggested. LLMP students are these Centrelink students. Maybe they're not always reluctant to attend class, but there are often other issues in their lives. They're often struggling with a whole host of... Also, a lot of higher-level students these days. I'm not so sure that it's actually basic education anymore, necessarily. And also younger people. Some colleges, depends on the college. A couple of colleges I know in the Northern Sydney Institute, they focus almost exclusively on young people these days. This is one little success story, I think. Integrated team teaching. Team teaching has been around for years and years in TAFE, from the time I came into TAFE, that they were talking about working together and team teaching, the idea that a literacy teacher would work with a vocational teacher and they would team teach. Now, because some colleges have been doing it for so long, those ABE class teachers are now fully integrated in those vocational sections. They're almost a member of those vocational sections. So whereas in the past, the language literacy and numeracy teacher, they were up the back helping the people who were struggling. But very often these days, they're down the front playing an equal part with the vocational teacher. Well, if that was in one of the colleges, would that be right? In the team teaching integrated, you've been doing it for years, haven't you? Janet, are you?
Yes, it is very nice aspect of the practice. Yeah, I think, especially in sections where adult basic ed teachers are staying and working for a while, it is like a proper team teaching. You both up front, you can have the chef delivering the lecture, but you know the students in the class who are going to have problems, so you're writing notes up for them, and you're kind of interacting in a very productive way.
Even when the students come in at the beginning of the year, the ABE teacher is there working with the vocational teacher, actually deciding on who comes into the group sometimes.
We screen the classes as well, so that then the teachers know as well who's going to perhaps have a problem in literacy and numeracy.
So you apply to have teen teachers in certain...
Now that it's well established in our college, the actual people from the sections, trade sections, they ask if we could provide a teacher to help them.
But sometimes they demand it. If we can't do it, can't possibly do it without the art basic teacher there. Technology is also changing the way, changing ABE pedagogy. You'd have to tell me what a wiki is. I don't know what a wiki is. What is a wiki? No? Okay. Well, it's been used by some teachers anyway.
It's interactive, isn't it? I mean, you can have a number of people.
It's a collaborative space.
Oh, okay.
It's meant to be.
And there's a lot of people working independently on the computer now, compared in the past. Someone suggested classrooms have become a lot more connected. You know, there's wireless classrooms and data projectors and smart board and that sort of thing. It's changing the way teaching is delivered. It changes that traditional way. Also, the last one's an interesting one. The space in the classroom. It's partly to do with the rise of computer literacy. In our big room has changed. It used to be two or three groups all working together. But then the computers took off and they spread around like a virus and took up 2/3 of the room. And I think all the ABE-ness that used to come naturally, we have to work really hard to manufacture that atmosphere. Right, the traditional ABE setup, you might have one big room like this, and you might have a class there, a class there, and a class there. With the spread of computers around the room in different parts, it's changing the dynamics of that small group. And you have to work really hard in order to get that, to maintain that small group tuition, professional development. When I first came into TAFE, I went into ALIO, the Adult Literacy Information Office. It was built in professional development. It was part of the structure. And not just TAFE, it was across the sectors. We've got nothing in the system. There are no conferences, no ABE, nothing. There's no annual conference anymore in TAFE for adult basic ed teachers. There's no ALIO anymore. Someone said, we don't speak about pedagogy much. But I don't think anyone does either. I haven't seen any new ideas around reading theory, writing theory. What's new? Maybe it's there, but we're not seeing it. No professional development. No one speaks about pedagogy anymore.
Well, we don't even have students. They're customers, aren't they?
Time.
Time, yeah. This week.
A fragmented field. We used to have meetings. There used to be interdisciplinary meetings. I remember when I first joined TAFE, 1988, at least, I think once a semester, all the ABE teachers, the ABE division used to organise a big conference. They used to come down from everywhere, from the North Coast and from Wagga Wagga, all around for these meetings, at least twice a year. But that doesn't happen anymore. Now, do we know another college exists? No. Do we ever meet them? No. Depends on the institute that you're in. in some institutes they've got a faculty model and there is more cooperation and AB exceptions in the colleges know more about what's going on. But it depends on which institute you're in. Two scenarios for the future. A little bit of a pessimistic view and a more optimistic view. This is a pessimistic view. There's going to be a vacuum, someone suggested. I'm worried about what's going to fill that vacuum. There won't be enough of us with all the knowledge that we've got to keep what's special about adult basic education. That was someone's comment. This is a bit nasty, I think. The induction for a new teacher is, here are your learning outcomes, this is your CLAMS role, and these are what you have to tick off for assessment validation. This is kind of the new take, if you like.
What's CLAMS?
CLAMS is the electronic role that you keep. You know, you used to have one of these pink roles that you filled in. But all the roles are on a computer base. So you're told, you know, you keep up your computer role. We're the older ones. Now there are younger ones coming in. They will only know this audit culture. And there's a couple of comments there on sort of new teachers coming through. We had a relatively new teacher. She found it very hard to produce her own worksheet. She became very dependent on websites for producing things. Nothing wrong with that, but younger teachers are coming in, are tapping in maybe to commercially available and currently available ones rather than making their own. And the second half one down there on teachers in one college were talking about having practicum students coming in. We had some TESOL students doing practicals last year. They're not teacher trained. I don't know if they're UTS, probably not. I'm sure they weren't. and they were very much teacher talk, stand in front of the room, pass out worksheets. And that's what we're concerned about with the CERT 4 people coming in, if they don't have a philosophy of education. And it's interesting watching students, these teacher trainees, watching you. I mean, where did you get that? I made it. You made it. The concept that you make all your own resources. A more optimistic view. I don't know if that's a pessimistic view, but there certainly it indicates there are a few little problems there. It's maybe getting away from the basic. It's not as basic as it was before. Someone went to this big skills conference where Julia Gillard spoke, and she was talking about foundation skills. And this teacher said, well, look, it's our day. Our day has arrived. You know, politically, we fought for it for so long and no one cared. Now it's recognised. Maybe there's a little political opportunism at the moment where it appears to be on the agenda as foundation skills, not as adult basic education.
I'm certainly coming across quite a few students who are being told, don't worry too much about English. Go and do a course that's going to get you work.
No,
don't worry too much about the English at all. And that rather frightens me.
In fact, you've got some colleges are changing their names as well. I mean, in the institute I'm from, there's a bit of a split between sections that used to be called adult basic ed and the other sections called adult foundation education. So even within one institute, you've got a fragmentation that'll actually call it a different name. It's happened in the Sydney Institute as well. The word foundation seems to be making its way in a little bit more rather than basic. I don't know if that's going to make that much difference though. And the very last point is that a teacher said, look, you've got workers, you can't pass the test. I think she was talking about Rail Corp or one of the public services. And they can't pass the test, but who do they go to in TAFE to get people up to the high level? There's nobody else apart from the ABS section. There isn't a course that teaches, you know, year 10 advanced maths in 8 weeks and communication skills to get through an interview. In other words, ABE is probably the only section that has the adaptability and the flexibility to come up with a course quickly to meet a particular student group. Maybe outreach, I would think, but it's only the ABE outreach, those sorts of groups that are sufficiently adaptable and flexible to meet those needs. Which is another argument for a kind of an optimistic view of where AB might fit. So that's basically all I've got. There's basically comments from teachers in the field, experienced AB practitioners.
I'm just wondering, I mean, in this room there are some UTS students who are studying either the grad dip in literacy and numeracy or the bachelor's programs to become adult language literacy and numeracy teachers, and I'm wondering, you know,
what can they look forward to, I guess, as they complete their degree and they've been encouraged to, this is the course to do, and literacy and numeracy is a really fulfilling and rewarding career, and have we misled them?
Well, if you go around to all this ABE section and you just look at the ages of the professors, there could be quite a few jobs in a few years' time.
Thanks. I still think it's a wonderful career. I think it's a fantastic career.
Yeah.
Absolutely wonderful. I still love what I do. I've been doing it. I've been an adult basic education teacher since the early 90s, and I loved it when I first came into the field, and I still absolutely love it. So, yeah. That's how I feel about it.
I love the actual face-to-face and student contact that I don't like a lot of the ticky-boxy.
Yeah.
Mm, so how do you cope with that?
Yeah.
How do you cope with
it? It's a great difficulty. And it detracts from, I feel it detracts from what I enjoy, what I do well, and what I should be employed to do, which is teaching.
Can we hear from someone who loves it?
Yeah, I think you have to really understand what you're being asked to do. And I think you've got to do the bare minimum. You understand what you've got to do, how much you've got to do, you work that out. And I think you work out what the minimum compliance that you've got to do. And if you do that, I think that people over comply. I think people don't understand really often what you've got to do, and they don't always understand the assessment. You know, we have units, but the most important part of I always go to the assessment part in the unit and really unpack what it means, because often it's not, it looks very onerous when you read it, but it might just be that the assessment task is a collection of work samples. A lot of our units is just a collection of work samples. Well, our students have always collected work samples, and that's the assessment event. So what I'm saying is it's really important that you understand your curriculum. Yes, we do have curriculum, but it's really important that we understand the curriculum and unpack it properly, and then just work out the minimum that you've got to do and do the minimum, and then you do comply by doing the minimum. And that's very much my philosophy, and I think we often, we get all caught up in compliance and instead of really trying to understand it and put it where it needs to be, or make it part of what we do, but really understand what we've got to do and do the minimum and move on with what's really important, which is our students.
I think the encouraging thing is a lot of those teachers, that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
In your percentage of your pragmatists and those three groups, I don't know how big your sample was. Also, their ages would be pretty relevant, possibly. But a bit of a percentage breakdown even of those three groups?
It was too qualitative. It was just based on several colleges. The demographics, I would say, the top end of the 50s, which I think would characterise the ABE teaching.
Right. No, but what I meant was how, so you there wasn't a, you made three groups, but you can't give a percentage out of the people you interviewed.
No, I wouldn't even try to. No, not with the number that I... And also, I think people who have known the 80s and 90s, they probably are going to be a bit resentful with a new regime that comes in. So, if you're interviewing people in their late 50s who have been working for 20, 30 years in adult basic education, then you're going to get a skew towards a little bit of discontent to have to fill out all this audit stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas if you come in and you're 30 years of age, you might...
Yeah. I was going to say that, it's fresh blood, and if we go in and that's just the norm, what we have to do, then we just accept it, part of the job.
It's just wonderful, you've got fresh blood, just fantastic, I think.
You've
got so much to offer.
There was almost a view when the training agenda changed all those years ago that we didn't fit that, so we weren't going to have anything to do with that. And a lot of people really wanted to opt out, as I'm sure you remember, Steve. And I think we would have gone by now if we hadn't sort of made an attempt to stay with it. Mm. To stay in the mainstream, to stay part of the game.
We've been dragged along with the vocational agenda. Whatever happens with carpentry and all those trade
There were a lot of people who were sort of saying, well, we don't fit there and let's just keep separate. Mm. I think we would have been absolutely lost if we hadn't made some effort to keep up with it.
I agree, because I think there's a lot of, I believe there is a move to sort of marginalise us if we don't sort of comply to a certain extent. I guess that, for me, that's my great fear, because I want to continue being an advocate. I want to continue addressing the needs of adult learners in a community that maybe they're not in workplace or in their sort of, but they, you know, in order to be able to address their needs, I actually have to comply a little bit with what's being imposed on me. And I think the key word is balance, maybe, sort of. And I hope what experienced teachers do is retain all the good things, but, you know, sort of, and try and sort of pass that down to newer teachers. And I must say, yes, the compliance stuff really gets hard at times, but it's really interesting to see, you know, the newer, the younger teachers coming on the staff and sort of embracing it. And yes, it's, but as Irene said, it's, you know, you sort of try and sort of move forward and try and keep the joy in teaching. And I guess that's our challenge.
But our students come first, you know. It's about our students, it's about their, you know, why they've come. And make a difference to their lives.
I think our curriculum writers too have been very clever in that they have kept our
incredibly clever
units very broad, so that we don't have to teach specific narrow topics and things. And I think that's been largely people who have the same philosophy that we have, who have used that very carefully in writing the curriculum, that we're not yet in very narrow, limited units.
Our curriculum is as wide as, you know, read simple text in everyday context. Well, how wide can you get, you know? So, you know.
And that's been a great pressure, I have to say. Yeah. So the other thing I'd say is when the, whatever it's called now, the curriculum
centre, which aren't back anymore,
asks the people to write units, put up your hand.
Yeah,
because if people don't come from the field to do those things,
then
other people who don't understand write it. And we'll lose that really good curriculum.
Mm.
Just saying that students coming first,
what we do is
talk with the students about their needs,
and choose a unit.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make the students' needs. Mm-hmm. So try and marry students' needs with a
group of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Units so that we fulfill
that. Absolutely.
So you're in community college? Yes. So what curriculum, I mean...
Certificate in general education.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's very good curriculum around, and there's very good... I mean, I personally think, you know...
Yeah, I think it's great that they have kept that flexibility.
Mm. Yeah. So I guess we need to remember too that everything goes in cycles, doesn't it? And I like the idea of foundation coming back just for our institute director comes from a building background, and he understands that poor foundations aren't a good thing. And perhaps, you know, that might ring some bells with people who have a more visual sort of way of seeing things. So.
Can I suggest that we accept for a very interesting presentation? I think we can continue the conversation in a slightly more informal way under drinks in the back. But just before we break up, well, not break up, but just before we go for the drinks, there's a very important issue for all of us, and a very urgent issue, and that is the future of the reading writing hotline. Some of you would be aware of this very important national referral advisory counselling service for people who are seeking assistance, help, advice, referrals for their literacy and numeracy needs. That's been a national service funded by the Commonwealth Government, but at the end of last year at the Council of Australian Government COAG meeting, for whatever reason, they decided that they were going to devolve the responsibility of the function of the hotline to the state. And we've been worried about that all year. None of the states have made any moves to pick it up, but at the same time, the Commonwealth government hasn't said, oh, we will reverse the decision we made last year. So we are encouraging everyone, literacy and numeracy practitioners, their children, their uncles, other people you know, to write to the state minister to say, you know, please urge the Commonwealth to pick up the service again, and writing to the federal minister, Julia Gillard, to say, please reconsider the decision you made and re-establish funding for the hotline. And there's going to be another COAG meeting, the Council of Australian Government meeting, in the first week of December, so there's just under a month to get anything done. And there's some information about this issue, copies of the letters we've written as a council. If you could take a copy of that, and if you could write a letter as either a literacy numeracy practitioner or a private citizen or a parent or a child or whatever, I think every little bit that we can do will help that campaign.
I think it would be great for students to write letters too. Mm. There's probably lots of students in your classes who've been referred from the hotline. That's a really nice election for them.
Writing simple text.